if I was working at my current company and they're like, hey, Tom, do you want to just like make the same amount of money you make now, but you just like answer our mail? Yes, I do. That sounds amazing. Can I do that, please? Hello, 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 and welcome to another episode of 1001 Album Complaints. This is the podcast where lifelong friends, musicians, and guys who can complain about free money get together to talk about albums from Robert Dimery's list of 1001 albums you must hear before you die. We're going to give some deep dives on individual tracks. We're going to talk about the history of the band leading up to the recording of the album, and we are going to make fun of this band. So if this is your first time listening to the podcast, be warned, there's going to be some shade thrown at this band. We love nothing more than anybody who puts themselves out there, puts their ideas to tape, but we all know there is a lot to make fun of when it comes to music. So if you have clicked on the link, you know that today we are talking about the June 29th, 1999 release by the band Slipknot, titled Slipknot. This is a new metal album. You will recall from our episode 53, our Kid Rock episode, that new metal is a big genre from the 90s. It's kind of credited as Korn and the Deftones were the forerunners of it. It's metal, but it kind of strips away a lot of the other super fast guitar licks and solos and stuff and focuses on syncopation, lyrics that are more personal, less bombastic. To give you an idea of what we are talking about, let's play the, I guess we'll say opening track, although the opening track is kind of not really a song. We're going to play the first real song on the album. This is the song called Sick. Excellent. Now that we have our baseline for what we're talking about, I am going to throw it around the room for our tweet length reviews, and I am going to go first to Marty.
Hey, what's up? Here is my tweet length review. We get it. You hate your dad. Do you have to scream so loudly about it?
All right. Coming in hot. I like it. And next, I'm going to throw it over to our special guest, and we will give a proper introduction to this guest in a moment. But first, we're going to hear the tweet length review from our special guest, Jason.
Ooh, you said tweet length, and right there, you effed me up because I don't understand Twitter. All I can say about this record is they managed to encapsulate everything about, I think, the people they dug, Limp Bizkit and Korn, the Deftones, and whatever rap music they were listening to at the time, and put it all into a very suburban package with an interesting tinge of And Justice for All era Metallica.
All right. Thank you, Jason.
I'm not a fan of the band.
Okay. There you go. Showing your cards early. I like it.
You know, I literally sat there and I was like, I don't like them. I remember being in a band with a guy that really liked them. And he's like, can we do this more like Slipknot? I was like, no. And I listened to this. I listened over and over again. And whoever made the playlist, thank you for making the playlist. And
shortening your experience so you didn't have to listen to the whole album.
I don't mind, man. Everybody on this screen has played a lot of shows. And, you know, there was about a 7-year period where we were playing like 100 shows a year. So I've heard a lot of music I hate. And after a while, just like, I don't really give a shit to really be that angry about it. But this stuff in particular to me is something I even write about. The I hate my dad sentiment, you can plaster that right on to hardcore punk from the 80s.
Yeah.
And it's funny because this music embodies that in spades. And I think this music takes what they assume is the cool stuff about the 80s and overly simplify it, because their issues weren't the same issues that were being confronted by newly downwardly mobile young men in the late 70s and early 80s. These are kids that are part of kind of a burgeoning blow up of suburbs. And there's a reason why this music kind of came and went.
And thank God it went. All right, Rob, let's get your tweet length review.
Ooh, this was a rough week. I'm not going to lie to you, but geez, Cookie Monster is a lot angrier than I remember.
You got to feed the monkey, Rob. You know, it's not easy to be getting those cookies every day.
Yeah.
All right. Seriously. And this is Tom. I will be taking us down the daisy-strewn meadow that is the journey through Slipknot. And my tweet length review is, for a band whose entire aesthetic is a shopping spree through a Spirit Halloween store, whose idea of guitar tone is what if a lawnmower ran over a pile of wet garbage, and whose lyrical content is aimed directly at sexually frustrated underclass 17-year-old Midwesterners, I found more to like in this album than I anticipated. However, I anticipated liking exactly nothing on it, so that is not a very high bar. All right. Now, before we get into our general impressions, I do want to throw it over to Jason. And thank you for coming on our show. Jason is from the This Is Revolution podcast. And why don't you tell us a little bit about the show and why people should listen to it?
Because it's fucking dope. The podcast started as something to do when we had downtime touring, and the band thought it was not a good idea. Here I am almost 5 years later, and it's way more successful than doing music.
All right.
Because I lived in a place called Soundwave Studios in West Oakland, California, where kind of a lot of my heroes practice. So bands from Flipper to Faith No More.
Tom and I used to have a space there. We so did. I assume yeah. you can add us to those ranks.
Yeah. So you know exactly. I lived in Third Eye Blind's old room. You know? Okay. So, living there, I figured we had all this access to all these cool people, and the band's like, I don't think that sounds interesting. And then we can infuse political talks, and then the show got more political. And but now I came across you guys because a friend of mine that I've actually played with was on your show.
Oh, yeah. Friend of the show, Conan Neutron. I mean, that man is like a human aggregator of talent. He just knows everybody. Yeah. I listened to the show that you did on the Cat Williams. Yeah. I dug it. I'll definitely go check that show out.
Yeah. Well, look, if you can't talk about pop culture and you have a very tight sphincter and all you want to talk about is politics, you're probably not a very interesting or entertaining person. I definitely use pop culture as a way to be an intro drug into, you know, more serious subjects. Like, for example, I wrote a little kind of an extended essay that got turned into a mini book. We got to have a book release party, which is, I wanted to make like an album release party because, you know, so I invited members of Exodus and Forbidden and Machine Head. And we had a fun little book launch. And I'm writing a follow-up to that book, which is going to encompass literally what we're talking about today, which is nu metal and how deregulation of finance helped build out the suburbs and made this very non-offensive music that we get in the 90s and 2000s. I don't know if we look at the music as non-offensive because it can be so aggressive. And one of the things that I think this band did aesthetically was appear aggressive in almost a campy horror movie kind of way. But they're really not saying anything that's going to cause the youth to get up and rebel.
It's an interesting point, because that's kind of my main complaint about this, is that it's really overwrought and whiny. And it really wants you to think it's extremely dangerous. So you're making an interesting point here that I would love to explore, but it's a weird... It feels like a haunted house somewhere in a corn maze in the Midwest. You know what I mean? It's shocking.
Yeah, Rob, I agree with you there. You know, there's an element of like backyard wrestling, or like the WWF as sure. part of it, and also some sort of like Midwest inferiority thing going on. Little brother.
You're basically saying this is like the white trash anthem. It's like
trying to be, maybe a little bit more descriptive.
Can I ask you guys this question? Is everybody on the screen a bit of a fan of the horror genre?
Oh, yeah. I love horror. Yeah.
Okay. If we think about the horror genre from the 70s and 80s, Wes Craven, Carpenter, Toby Hooper, these are all guys that are products of the new left of the 60s. These guys, in their movies, they're trying to make larger statements than boo. if you watch those movies and you've read all the JSTOR articles about them, if you've read all the interviews about them, you know, even throw Star Wars into the mix as well. These were their protest films. Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Halloween is a great big middle finger to suburban excess. These guys watching it don't get that. They're not trying to get that. And for them, it's just boo and gore.
Yeah. I think that they look at it like a roller coaster, which is a very safe version of danger. Mm. And it's just sort of like, this music came across as a roller coaster to me. It's a safe version of being dangerous. In all reality, nothing is happening.
They seem to take themselves very seriously. I mean,
yeah,
the drummer had a line of drumsticks where he put his blood in it. It's like his actual blood in the drumsticks that you could buy at the store.
I will say this. They are very good at marketing. They really hit an aesthetic, and they nailed it. They're modern-day Kiss in that sense, and their music is also kind of boring. Like, Kiss's music is boring. Basically, there's two flavors of Slipknot on this album. There is the I'm super angry, very aggressive, yelly, and frankly, like, that stuff I kind of liked. The I'm sad Slipknot I really did not like at all. Oh my God, shut the fuck up.
I've never understand that. That was this weird thing that was happening with that music. I went and did something, and I don't know if you guys do this too, preparing. I was like, what else came out in 2001 metal-wise? And there's a band called Entombed. And I listened to their record that came out around the same time. And I was like, this is more interesting. And there's a lot of other nu metal records that came out. I think Seven Dust released Animosity around this time. This really shows that it's so much about marketing in the era of music television. And we have to remember that Slipknot can't be Slipknot today without MTV.
Oh, yeah. And also, I would say that when it comes to metal, it is not the most accessible genre. And one of the reasons why nu metal hit is because they said, let's strip away the complexity of metal and keep the distortion and the anger, but basically turn them into very simply constructed pop songs that are just heavy and angry. And that allowed a lot more people to say, oh, I can understand what's going on here. This isn't a weird time signature. This isn't a shreddy guitar solo that's going through crazy, you know, Mixolydian modes and whatnot. Like, it's all very easy to grok because it's just syncopated rhythms and heavy guitars and a guy yelling at you.
Well, I almost can't believe we've gone this long without calling out that the drummer in this band goes hard. I mean, he is the best thing about this band, kind of by a mile, in my opinion.
The late Joey Jordison, yeah.
He is definitely the best part of the band musically. I will say that one of the things that really bugged me on this album is that they use such an extreme noise gate on that snare that there's absolutely no decay. It is just like a pop, and that's it. And it's so slathered over the entire drum sound on the album. It sounds unnatural. And it just wore on me as the album went on. I was like, give me.
Did Ross Robinson do this record?
He did. Yeah.
How do you guys feel about Ross Robinson's production?
I feel like a lot of the nu metal producers, they have two presets that they hit. There's the preset for the drums, and here's the preset for that terrible vocal approach when he tries to sing and it does that thing that you're like, oh, that sounds like any other band from the 90s. Yeah. I cannot stand it. All right, we're going to get into the background of the band. And there's a lot, because there's a lot of guys in this band. So before we do that...
too many, some might say.
Is it nine? Is it nine of them?
Yes, and perfect segue into our By the Numbers segment. And the first number is nine, because there are nine members in this band, and I don't know what, like, five of them are doing.
That's at least three too many.
It's at least three too many.
There's two additional percussionists in the band, right?
A DJ.
A DJ and a sampler, which is ridiculous. Wow. What is the difference? Yes.
How is that a different job?
All right. The next number that we are going to do is 40,000. As in $40,000, the amount that Slipknot reportedly spent on their first self-funded album, Mate, Feed, Kill, Repeat.
Why?
Wait, how?
Here's the thing.
I've been to Iowa.
Yeah. We'll get into that later. But, like, I have released 6 full-length albums, 1 EP, and recorded 2 more full-length albums worth of material and 2 more EPs worth of material that haven't been released, and I have not spent anywhere close to $40,000 doing that. They got fucking ripped off, which is kind of terrible, especially because they made this album and then everybody was like, oh, that's a demo. That's not an album. That's just a demo. Yeah. So good on whatever that studio owner was for just milking them for all the money that they had. It's goddamn ridiculous. He's
still cashing checks from that.
So that's where the anger's coming from.
Yeah. All right. But speaking of cashing checks, 2.7 million, which is the copies of this album that were sold worldwide, which is goddamn ridiculous. Number one is the chart position for Slipknot on the U.S. independent album charts, as well as the U.S. Heatseekers charts, which is crazy that this album could have a number one chart position on any chart whatsoever. It's not accessible. It's not for the masses. And somehow they struck a vein and this sold to an extreme degree. And then the last number that we are going to do is just every goddamn day, which is how often former singer and percussionist Anders Karlsefni, who left the band shortly before this album was produced, must be kicking himself. Because goddamn, did he miss out on a payday.
And what was the sticking point, that he didn't want to wear a mask?
The sticking point was that they got a different singer and they were like, why don't you just be a percussionist? And he's like, no, fuck that. Like, dude, that's the easiest job in the world, man. You'd be cashing checks, just sitting in the background, just going ting, 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 ting.
I got a baseball bat. I got a beer keg here. Let's do this thing.
I interviewed Tom Werman, the guy that found Kiss.
Okay.
And the producer, he did like Blue Oyster Cult and Ted Nugent, all these other bands. And I asked him, I said, what did the label say when you brought him Kiss? Did they tell you to go fuck yourself and never do that again? He goes, yes. The president of the label, when I was in A&R, we saw Kiss. They had just done put on makeup and they were called Wicked Lester before, and somebody left. And he goes, and they had this makeup on. They go, this is our new thing. It's Kiss. And so he said he showed it to his boss, and his boss was like, this is the worst I've ever seen. I'll never fucking do this again.
And then 3 years later, when he's buying his third house with the Kiss checks, he's like, you know what, man? Maybe you had a point there. All right. Thank you to everybody for listening to the show. Just quick plugs. You know, we got a Patreon page. We actually just have released, I believe, the final episode of our 90s song battle is available exclusively to our Patreon listeners. If you want to go there, check it out. We're going to continue to give you all this content every week for free, but we are doing some Patreon exclusive stuff. Go check it out. I somehow managed to get the notoriously unflappable Adam mad at me. It's really great. It gets super chippy and personal as we fight over the best song of the 90s. We got some t-shirts. If you want to give us a review, we would love a review as well. Thank you for listening to our pluggables. Now we're going to dive into the background of Slipknot. And spoiler alert, to say that it is a little haphazard and hectic is underselling it a whole lot. All right. So Slipknot is a nonet. 9 guys in the band. Corey Taylor on vocals, Mick Thompson on guitars, Sean Clown Cran on percussion, Craig 133 Jones on samples, Josh Brainerd on guitars, who quit the band after the recording of this album, and was replaced by Jim Root, who actually only appears on one track on this album. You got Chris Fenn on percussion, who is credited on the album, but the only sound that he actually gets on the album is him vomiting on a track. You got Paul Gray on bass, Joey Jordison on drums, and Sid Wilson on turntables. There's actually one more guy, Greg Cuddles Welts, who apparently plays percussion on a couple of the tracks, but only made it on Spit It Out. He leaves the band before this album actually comes out. So
how do you get that many people in a band? I want to know. Do you go to a mall?
You just decide you don't want to make any money. You're like, I don't want to make any money.
Do you just walk around and ask people in public, like, do you want to be in my band? Do you play any instruments?
It's actually kind of interesting. We're going to start the story with Sean Clown Cran. All right. Slipknot is described as his brainchild. He's been responsible for a lot of the visual aspects of the band and the, like, their overall ethos of sort of anti-capitalist, anarchic, basically like a whole host of antisocial beliefs.
That's some shit he made up because they sell records.
Oh, yeah. But he somehow got really pissed off about it and was like, I hate this fucking business and making me all this money. I don't know if I can do this anymore. I mean, you mean stand in the background and hit a drum every 5 minutes? Are you fucking kidding
me? Wait. Time out. He really said anti-capitalist? They like showcased. This isn't the internet era where, you know, you get MySpace famous. Like, you had to go find a record label to give a shit about you.
Oh, yeah. No, and they purposefully hunted for a record label.
That is awesome.
Listen, it's easy to be anti-capitalist once you've made all of your money. And you're like, capitalism fucking sucks, man.
I don't even understand how that came out of his mouth.
All right. So, Sean Cran, he's a native of Des Moines, Iowa. Right. And so he grew up in Iowa. In his 20s, he was a welder in Des Moines, living a very depressing life, getting up super early to go to work as a welder, working himself to the point of exhaustion to make ends meet. Apparently, he would routinely fall asleep at the wheel while driving home from work and had many brushes with death with car accidents. And then, coupled with a death in his family in his early 20s, he kind of had this realization that he wanted to do something more with his life. He was not satisfied with just being a blue-collar worker in Iowa, and he wanted to create the biggest band on the planet. That was his stated goal. And so he picks the universally accessible and notoriously liked genre of thrash metal for this project.
So is he just like playing cowbell and starting a band?
No,
with that?
He's a drummer.
Oh, he's a drummer. Okay. Yeah. Got it.
So it's 1992, and he forms a band called Heads on the Wall, who played, and I quote, funk metal cover songs, which just sounds terrible. I want no part of that. But like, all right, whatever. We're going to move past it because there's a lot of shit to get through here. One of the important things to note, and Marty, this kind of gets to your comment about how do you get nine guys in your band, is that the Des Moines metal scene is actually pretty tight-knit and very incestuous. Lots of swapping of members. And the band, Slipknot, I guess it would be more accurate to say the several bands that ended up coalescing to form Slipknot, are kind of gaining and shedding members, swapping members throughout this time. So it's a small scene, and all these guys kind of know each other. In the early 90s, the biggest band is this band called Atomic Opera, which has Jim Root as their guitar player. And there's another thrash metal band performing at the time called Modifidius, who has as their drummer Joey Jordison. They're kind of decently successful in the local scene. They're not huge or anything. Like, it's not a big scene. But after opening for Atomic Opera, their guitar player decides, fuck it, I'm going to leave and I'm going to join Atomic Opera. Jordison then says, hey, I need to find another guitar player. And he gets Craig Jones to join the band on guitar. Because Craig Jones, regardless of the fact that he is a sampler in Slipknot, is actually a guitar player. More on that later. So Cran at the time, he knows a bassist named Paul Gray. Paul's also living in Des Moines. He's actually born and lived for part of his life in L.A., and then his family relocated to Des Moines later. So he is very pissed off about that, understandably so.
Understandably,
yeah. You go from Des Moines to from L.A. to Des Moines. That's not an upgrade, I gotta say. So Gray, he's very active in the Iowa metal scene, playing in such bands as Sudden Infant Death Syndrome and Anal Blast.
It's like a good one. You're making up names.
I think both of those are real things, but okay.
That's right up there with Butt Problems, also from Soundwave Studios.
Butt Problems is a very good name. Butt Problems is more accessible than Anal Blast. Anal Blast is off-putting. Butt Problems, you're like, I can relate to that. Yeah, I've had some of those before. All right, so Gray is playing in a band called Vex with two X's, and Josh Brainard is on guitar, and a guy named Anders Kolsefni is on drums. Eventually, Anders Kolsefni takes over vocal duties in the band and kind of establishes himself as a singer. Based on their mutual connection, Cran and Gray get together in Gray's basement. They kind of play and record some music with Kolsefni on vocals and some other random unimportant dude who's playing guitar. It is during that time that they record a song called Slipknot, which, to hear the story, is actually the song Sick, the opening song on this album in its early form. But it has Anders Karlsefni on vocals. It's given a completely different approach. There's a different drummer. Everything is different about it. But that was the nugget of the song. So no band is officially formed in these sessions, but Gray forms this band called Inveigh Catharsis. Terrible band name. Karlsefni's back on drums. Josh Brainard's on guitar. Modafidius, they're still going strong. So it's like 1994. And they're actually going so strong that Josh Brainard leaves Inveigh Catharsis for Modafidius. But then they kind of break up soon thereafter. Gray forms another band called Body Pit, again with Anders Karlsefni, and a guy on guitar named Donnie Steele. He actually tries to recruit Joey Jordison on drums, but Jordison declines, and they get Mick Thompson in the band. So Thompson, another Des Moines lifer.
This is like a Kafka novel.
I know. It's fucking ridiculous. I had to, like, I was going cross-eyed trying to keep all these fucking names together. My notation of, like, who is what in this is, it's overly descriptive because I cannot follow any of this shit.
Can we start referring to them by their mask types? Is it, which guy is the Casey Jones Quiet Riot guy? Which guy is that?
That's way more. The butthole face, the alien.
All right, so we got Mick Thompson. He's a Des Moines lifer again, obsessed with metal. Big Beatles fan, apparently, too. You can really tell the melodic influence of the Beatles on this Slipknot album. In 94, he joins Body Pit. He's 21 years old. He's trying to make it in the music scene. He's basically giving guitar lessons to shitty little kids for money, and that's how he's making his real money. But he wants to join a successful band, so he's pretty stoked when he gets to join Body Pit because they're kind of a successful local band. But as soon as he joins, they break up, basically. So September 1995, Paul Gray, the bassist, again, he's out in the wind. He's put together several bands that were kind of big in the Des Moines metal scene, but nobody ever broke out of that small regional area. And Cran's plan to create the biggest band in the world is not going so hot. He's still playing funk metal covers in his band, Heads on the Wall. Eventually, he meets up with Gray. They kind of talk about, hey, remember we did those sessions a few years back? They were pretty good. They team up again with Anders Karlsefni, who had been the singer in their sessions back in the day, and they form a group called Pale Ones. They recruit Donnie Steele on guitar, and they're trying to round out their lineup. They have Gray, who plays bass, Steele, who plays guitar, Cran, who plays drums, Karlsefni, who plays drums and sings. And so they're like, who do we need? We need another drummer. That's what we need. So they go out and they recruit Joey Jordison because he's looking for a project. At the time, his band had broken up. And Paul Gray invites him to kind of come over and play with Pale Ones. And listen, I don't know how good Cran or Karlsefni were at the drums, but I do know that immediately they were both pushed to percussion and Joey Jordison took over on drums.
Listen, props to Clown for accepting that instantaneously and moving to percussion. That was the correct move.
Yeah. Again, it's the easiest job in the world. It's like if I was working at my current company and they're like, hey, Tom, do you want to just like make the same amount of money you make now, but you just like answer our mail? Yes, I do. That sounds amazing. Can I do that, please? Yeah. It's basically that level of, it's a lateral move because the pay is the same, but at this point, the pay is nothing.
The drummer's nervous before the show. You're like, why are you so nervous? You know?
Yeah. You got me backing you up, man. I got my little ding-to-ding-dings going on. All right. So Karlsefni's doing the lead vocals. Cran's doing the backup vocals. They get Josh Brainard as a second guitar player, mostly because like he and Jordison were kind of tight from their days in Modafidius. So we got six members now. And in any reasonable band, the story of adding members would be over. But oh no, the story is not even close to over. This is a goddamn mess, all right? So they're in Pale Ones. But that name doesn't last long. Within 2 months, they call themselves Meld. This is November of 1995. They're playing as Meld. Cran is still determined to be the biggest band in the world. He and Gray, they kind of spend countless nights hanging out at a local gas station where Jordison was working the night shift to strategize about the future and direction of the band. because apparently it takes a really long time to say, let's all wear masks and invite a bunch of deadweight performers in the band so we have to split our money up nine ways. Like, I don't fucking understand that. But one of the key takeaways from these late night hang sessions was the decision to change the band name to Slipknot. And I think that that was a really good decision. Slipknot is a good name for this kind of a band. Certainly better than Meld. And we talked a bit about the marketing aspect of it. Like, that's good marketing. It sounds hardcore.
Well, the other bands that had masks before them didn't hit. Mushroom Head. You don't walk around going, Mushroom Head. Like, fuck yeah. I'm sure that person exists somewhere in Cleveland, but I've never met him.
Yeah. And, you know, if your band name is evocative of a dick, it's hit or miss on that one. Hit or miss. All right, so Slipknot is performing in the area. They pretty quickly decide, we got to get into the studio. They have no record contract, no real prospect of a record contract, but they're super serious about it. So they book themselves some time at SR Audio in Des Moines and start recording an album. I'm sorry, I mean start getting milked for all of their goddamn savings. Because this is where they get $40,000.
Gonna be $1,000 an hour, young guys.
That is such an insane number. I cannot understand. So they left with the album recorded, produced, mixed, and 1,000 copies of it burned on CD.
How long did this take? Did you find that out?
For $40,000. It took like a month and a half or something. Like,
ooh, I was hoping you'd say a year.
No.
I'd feel a little better if you said a year.
So technically, it was December 95 to March 96, but they weren't in there like every day.
Oof. 40 grand, I'm in there every day.
40 grand is a lot of, like, you could make a fucking Police album for less than 40 grand pretty easily. And that includes tickets to the Bahamas to like record on the beachfront. All right. But again, to add insult to injury, the album that they produced is basically super shitty in quality. And everyone was like, well, that's kind of a decent demo, but like, that's not going to sell. So they're having some turmoil. And this was like my favorite part of the research, is that during the recording process for Mate, Feed, Repeat, Kill, guitarist Donnie Steele is like, hey, wait a second. I'm a devout Christian. Are we like a angry satanic band or something like that? Like, and I can only hypothesize that this is the first time he was able to understand the lyrics.
Oh yeah.
I was like, oh, that's what you're saying? I can't be in this band anymore. I have to quit. And so he quits, basically for like moral reasons. He's like, I just couldn't take it. It was against my beliefs as a devout Christian.
What were they talking about at band practice? That's what I'm confused.
Right? Right. Yeah, put on this bloody pig mask here. Yeah. No. We're a pretty down the middle band. Yeah. Everything's pretty great.
It's a good time to drop in that I happen to be researching Des Moines, Iowa, because I know so little about it. And I caught this little factoid that between 1942 and 2009, there was a city ordinance that made dancing illegal.
Footloose town.
Yeah. They grew up in Footloose.
Oh, man. The only other explanation that I can think for Donnie Steele leaving the band is that he was like watching the bills rack up, and he's like, at some point they're going to make me pay my sixth of this 40 grand.
He's gonna have to steal from the collection basket.
This is such the antithesis of the Nirvana story where like they got the guy in because they needed to pay like the $800 for that first record. And that makes more sense for a band recording a record, in my opinion. And 95, I was doing music shit in 95, and I don't, in like real studios, but how real was that studio? Because there's also like the reality factor. Like, you try to walk in like fantasy studios in Berkeley in 1995. They were booked.
Yeah, you're not getting into that.
You're not even getting in. And if you are getting in, it's one of those like, oh, an intern is going to, we're going to get you in at 1 a.m. when fucking Grateful Dead leave.
Right.
And you can't touch the cocaine bowl.
We looked at Electric Ladyland Studios in New York not that long ago, and we could have recorded like three albums for $40,000 at fucking Electric Ladyland Studios, not AR Studios in Des Moines, Iowa.
Like, yeah. It's a function not only of how expensive the studio is, which they get expensive, of course, but they can be really cheap. Like even really good professional studios can maybe run for $600 or $800 a day with the guy working there as the engineer. You know, they go up from there, but it's probably more a function of how slow they were at doing the thing, right?
But if you say it sounds bad, were they like, no, put those good microphones away. We got these ones from Radio Shack. They're the same thing, brother.
It's
and we're not even talking about this album, which actually sounds pretty good production-wise. We're talking about like another album. We're not even at this album.
Yeah, we're talking about their first album. We're not even at their album yet. There's like four more members we got to add to this fucking mix before we get to this album.
I'm so baffled by that. Like the mixing process is going to take 18 hours a day. Like, what were they?
I'm sure the guy was saying it with a straight face and just were like, yeah, so it'll be like $2,000 a day. Yeah. And they're like, oh, okay. We better.
Oh, you guys want reverb on this track? That's going to cost you.
Yeah. We'll give the reverb upsell quote here. All right. So, hey, listen, Donnie Steele leaves the band and Craig Jones comes in to replace him on guitar. And then almost immediately moves over to samples because apparently they were just putting such complex samples on their songs that they couldn't reproduce live. And like, oh, we need a sampler. And he's like, you know what? I'll be the sampler. Again, just the easiest goddamn job in the world.
I'm going to guess that the sample guy is the guy with the spikes coming out of his head.
He
Am I right?
is the guy with the spikes Whoa! Coming out of his head. Yeah. There we go. All right. So. They're like, oh, shit, we just lost our second guitar player again because he's now a sampler. He didn't leave the band or anything. He's still collecting a check. But he has moved over, and so we need to replace him again. So in steps Mick Thompson, who, remember, had played in Body Pit with Paul Gray. So let's level set again here. It's 1997. We got Cran on percussion, Gray on bass, Jordison on drums, Craig Jones on samples, Mick Thompson on guitar, Josh Brainert on guitar, and Colsefni on vocals and percussions. They have spent a ridiculous amount of money to record their first album, Mate, Feed, Repeat, Kill. They have 1,000 CDs printed, no distribution deal. They're selling them themselves. They eventually get a deal with Ismist Records for distribution, but they're like getting no play, no label interest. And they do have the whole look going on, though. They're playing live shows. They got the whole act where they're dressed up in fucking pig masks and shit and wearing matching like suits with numbers and stuff. That's all kind of baked in at this point. But they're like, we need to get a record contract. They're getting no label interest. So this is where we enter Corey Taylor, who is the vocalist on the album and I think is a very important member of the band. So Taylor, born in 73 in Des Moines, spent his early years in nearby Waterloo, which is as depressing as it sounds, I'm sure. He was raised by a single mom who, like most single moms, especially in the 70s, didn't have a lot of economic prospects. So he ended up moving around a lot so his mom could find work. He says that by the time he turned 15, he had already lived in 25 states, which is got to be just like crazy isolating. You're never developing real relationships, or even if you do, maybe it's worse because you have to leave them in like 6 months or something like that.
Sounds like his mama was on the run. I mean, who needs jobs that quick?
That's a lot of states. That's true.
Yeah, either he's full of shit or his mama's on the run.
To give you an idea of what his child life was like, he had already overdosed twice by the time he was 15 years old. So, yeah, his mom is not a very attentive mother, shall we say. He also was sexually abused when he was 10 years old and like kind of didn't tell his mom about it, but his mom also didn't notice that this life-altering event had happened. It sounds pretty fucking terrible, all in all. But
can I just jump in with a positive comment, which is listening to interviews of these guys, Corey Taylor did seem pretty down to earth and chill. I kind of like liked him. He just seemed very sane and kind of humble, even in interviews from around this time.
Did you see recently he quit?
Oh,
really?
He's taking a break from everything. He was on tour for a solo thing. He's keeping his Asia dates and he canceled all these other dates that he was supposed to do for a solo project because he's officially burnt out.
I mean, honestly, he's probably very loaded at this point because Slipknot sold a goddamn lot of albums. And so, you know, at some point you might as well just sit back and enjoy it.
I get tired just listening to him sing.
Yeah. Add the caveat, they sold records when people were buying records.
That's huge, the huge difference.
Yeah, yep. In the CD era. In the CD era, they sold records.
Those are the people that have what we like to call in poor circles, fuck you money.
Oh, yes. Yes. All right, so his childhood is total shit. The one saving grace of his childhood is his grandmother, who is kind of like the only stable person that he knows, and she ends up introducing him to rock music. Kind of early in life, he becomes a big fan of Elvis. He likes Black Sabbath. And at the age of 15, after, again, overdosing twice, he basically says, fuck this, I'm moving in with my grandmother. His grandmother takes custody of him, and she ends up becoming a big booster of his musical aspirations and is like helping him buy equipment, driving him to gigs, really encouraging him. And he has credited his grandmother with basically saving his life and pointing him in a direction that he could pursue something that was positive. And so, you know, 18, he moves out. He's trying to make it as a singer. He's doing some various odd jobs, but he's in a band called Stone Sour from like 92 to 97, and they're playing around Des Moines. He's kind of treading in the same waters as Slipknot, and he's actually at the first show that Slipknot plays as Slipknot, and he's apparently blown away by the band. And his statement was, this band is fantastic, their singer sucks, I'm going to be the singer in that band. Wow. And dude, if you will it, it is no dream, you know? He makes it happen. In 1998, Slipknot decides, listen, we've had this first album that we spent a ton of money on, didn't really work. We need to go back in the studio. And I'm sure the studio guys were calling him every day like, hey, you want to come record another album, guys?
Like, yeah. No, like, I bought a new Mercedes and I want a second one for my wife.
Now, we do charge per band member.
But they are like, Jason, to call back to what you had said earlier, they're like, we need to create a demo specifically for record labels to notice us. We're going to go back in and create a product that we can shop around to record labels. And they decide that they want to have a more melodic feel to their songs. And listen, I know you hear this album and you're like, a more melodic feel. If you listen to their first album, it is actually more melodic. This is more melodic. It says a lot about what that first album, Mate, Feed, Repeat, Kill, sounded like. But
you keep saying it's got to be repeat at the end, right? Or they're not that grammatically.
I'm sorry, Mate, Feed, Kill, Repeat. What the fuck ever? There's too many things for me to try to keep him the old duder's head here. This one's a little confusing for me. So anyway, they bring in Corey Taylor. They go back in the studio. They record a 5-song EP. And Colsefni is not happy being relegated to percussion. He's like, this is fucking bullshit. And he quits the band.
This is where band members go to die.
Yes. Yeah. Like,
percussionists don't get puss, dude.
It's funny. Yeah, they're basically a bunch of pussies. They just like let everyone still remain in the band. They're like, you're not the singer anymore, but you can play percussion. There's already 4 percussion players. It's like, do you want to be in the band or not?
Yeah. Hey, but Colsefni says, no, I'm taking a stand. I will not be in the band. And you would think that they already have a drummer and a percussionist, and so they're good. But no, they recruit another percussionist, a guy called Greg Cuddles Welts, to join the band as the second percussionist. Apparently, this is a very necessary part of their show. I don't know what the fuck they were thinking.
I do feel like rhythm and percussion is an important part of their aesthetic, and watching live videos of them, it does look cool to have 2 extra guys banging on big tom-toms in the front. They don't do it the whole show, but they do it occasionally.
But their drummer's playing like a million notes per second also.
Well, that's what I was going to say. It makes the least sense with this particular drummer because he plays so fast and so many notes. It really feels even less necessary than normal.
And he's so precise. Can we add how precise Joey Jordison was?
Oh, he's good.
Totally. And creative, too. I really think he's a great drummer, not just a fast drummer.
It is a loss. It is a loss to the music world. I will say that. The strength of this kind of music is in the groove, is in the rhythm section. One of the things that I think no one really talks about with nu metal is it's really not just the end of mid-range guitar tone and no solos, but it's also the beginning of very complicated drum parts, because you have a bunch of kids that grew up watching MTV. So they grew up listening to hip hop as well. And it's also the time where heavy music stops being so white and you start to have different ethnicities adding to the heavy genre. Probably you could say starting with like Roots. We can't undersell the fact that it really was something different. I may not have liked 90% of it, but
90% seems low, by the way. I'm going for like 98% of it.
Yeah. I was gonna say one of these songs actually sounded to me, reminded me of a Fishbone song.
I mean, that's another band with like 15 members, you know, like we joke, yeah. But ska bands, like the real No Doubt is like 9 people. It's not those 4 or 5 that you see on stage. It's like 9. There's a horn section, and Fishbone had a horn section and all that ska stuff.
Yeah, but horn section is a thing that requires multiple people. Percussion section is not a thing.
Yeah. Unless you're in like some crazy Latin jazz fusion band or something like that.
It's coming at you live.
All right. So we're going to get back to this story. So Slipknot, I'm doing spoiler alert here. They don't have enough members. And they're like, you know, we really need one more guy to tie this whole lineup together. They end up getting a DJ named Sid Wilson involved as well. And I don't understand why. They have a sampler already. They got a DJ, but they're like a charity project, I think, for people in Des Moines to lift themselves up out of their economic situation. So, you know, good on them for that. The demo that they record, it actually works to attract studio attention. And in June 1998, they sign a 7-album deal with Roadrunner Records and get a $500,000 advance.
Wow.
Probably only $200,000 of which they had to pay back to that studio that they used. Yeah. All right, so they got a record contract. They got a $500,000 advance. They've made it. They get to travel to sunny Malibu, California in September 1998, which you're coming from Des Moines, Iowa in September, and you go and spend 2 months recording their self-titled album, Slipknot. Now, apparently the recording process was super crazy and chaotic, and Ross Robinson signs on to produce them. He actually was the guy who like signed them originally and then kind of signed their contract over to Roadrunner with the expectation that he was going to produce it as well. But he is very much feeding into the chaos of this recording session. He's like fucking with the band members while they're recording and, you know, starting fights and throwing shit. They recorded the drums in 3 days, which is actually kind of incredible. It gives it this like nice, really raw and kind of live feel. But you've fought through all of this bullshit of the Iowa scene, sinking a ton of money into the project, not making any of it back. You finally get a record contract. And what does fucking Josh Brainer do? He quits the band. Despite recording guitars on all tracks except for one, he quits because of creative differences. And Jim Root, who we had talked about earlier in the story, just gets to step into like the perfect situation and take over as the guitar player.
So who's writing all the music? Are they doing it collaboratively as like 9 people?
It's a little bit of a collaborative process in terms of like, if you look at what the official credits are, all songs are written and composed by Sean Cran, Chris Fenn, Paul Gray, Craig Jones, Joey Jordison, Corey Taylor, Mick Johnson, Sid Wilson. It's the fucking whole band.
How could
basically,
that not be
that
chaotic
saying.
In a studio setting, you know?
Yeah. It sounds stupid and terrible, but it's a surprise hit. Like, surprise to everybody. The recording, the record label, to the band themselves, they somehow get this dedicated fan base that's kind of drawn to this disaffected, confused, pissed off sound that they have. And it goes double platinum in the US.
Damn.
Which is fucking crazy. And how is it received? It's received incredibly well for a not very accessible album. And I'm going to read not the entirety, but a chunk of the Rick Anderson All Music review here, which is, you thought Limp Bizkit was hard? they're the Osmonds. These guys are something else entirely, and it's pretty impressive. Although those lyrics that are discernible are not generally quotable on a family website, suffice it to say that the members of Slipknot are not impressed with their fathers, their hometown, or most anything else. And yeah, it does kind of, Jason, to your point, come off as a bunch of guys who are just like, fucking goddamn, everything sucks. Man, my life is boring. You're like,
they literally have a song later that's entitled People Equal Shit.
All right, so we are at the release of Slipknot. It is June 1999. Let's talk a bit about some of the specific tracks. We are going to revisit the, again, we're going to call it the opening track on the album. This is Sick. You can't kill me cause I'm already inside you. You can't kill me cause I'm already inside you. You can't kill me cause I'm already inside you. You can't kill me cause I'm already inside you. Sick. First word of this song is just pain.
Look, I'm not gonna lie, the first 75% of the week just felt like punishment. Like I don't like this music. This is harsh to my ears. It took me several listens and a long time to start getting into some nuances, and I think we already touched on some of the reasons why I think I have a hard time with it. It feels dumbed down in a lot of ways, and it feels laughably immature, and it feels humorless. Now, that said, I think this is one of the better tracks.
This song kind of rocks, and it has that, I mean, like, listen, they nail their audience with that chorus of, fuck this shit, I'm sick of it, you're going down, this is a war.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
That scream. Yeah. I mean, 17-year-olds were going nuts.
Oh, yeah, you got to fight with your parents. You go in your bedroom, slam the door, you know, put on your black light and turn this shit on, you know?
This is a war, Mom and Dad, in my nice bedroom.
How funny is that, that this band and Rage Against the Machine have the same effect?
Yeah.
That's what I find so hilarious about this moment in time when we think about youth. When you think about a band like Rage, who literally wears their communism on their sleeve, and for people like Paul Ryan to be like, I don't love Rage Against the Machine. It's like my favorite band.
Yeah.
Fuck you. I don't do what you tell me is just a middle finger to your parents. And that's kind of how that band came off to a lot of people. And so, yeah, I see why you can listen to Rage and Slipknot and not see the irony in that.
But here we are having that close listen. And I understand how one could think that. And fuck you, I won't do what you tell me. If that's your one takeaway, then you're right. They build up to just that very immature thing, right? That vamp, which is great, by the way. We've talked about it on the show before.
Made for the festival circuit, which is a thing that is booming in the mid-90s and late-90s. And then we get Woodstock 99.
But I think on close listen, I'm sure you would all agree, Rage Against the Machine has an undercurrent of intelligence to it.
Oh, yeah, they have substance. They have a lot more substance than this. Yeah.
Musically, too. Yeah.
And they understand history as well. This is sort of like devoid of any context.
One thing I noticed about this song, and I've never listened to this band before. I've heard of them. I've always never listened to them at all. On purpose, anyway. They do this thing where they have this really heavy stuff, and then they'll just start, like, singing.
Yeah, so... That is, I will say that Corey Taylor, for a guy who is growling and screaming, he has an expressive voice. It's not just bah, 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 the whole time. He's kind of given some pitch, and there's a little bit more melodically happening with it than I thought was going to happen. But it's still not really my kind of music. I will say, you're stuck in traffic listening to this shit at full volume, and you can kind of be like, yeah, fuck this shit. Yeah.
I literally rolled my window up as I was driving back.
I'm embarrassed as well. I'm with Jason on this one, but I'll compliment Corey Taylor. I do think he's a good vocalist. He's an expressive vocalist, and this stuff requires a certain level of acting delivery. Like, take this section here and around 2:15 where he starts saying, "You can't kill me because I'm already inside you." He's got to kind of like deliver that line several times in different, slightly different ways each time. He sells it.
Yeah. Well, he kind of has to because they repeat a lot of lyrics in these songs. Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
But that also, as we said, I think with the Oasis album, that allows people to sing along very easily.
Like, it's for the stadiums.
I got it. Yeah. And can we just talk about the irreplaceable contribution of Chris Clown Cran at the 150 mark, where, again, I'm actually pretty sure he is just hitting a keg with a baseball bat. He's kind of punctuating the word mine. Yeah. Just begun. It's about that time, gonna get mine. Just begun. It's about that time, gonna get
mine. Just begun. It's about that time, gonna get mine. Just begun. But some music journalist wrote about that like it was the most creative thing ever.
Yeah.
And that's when he took the baseball bat and music was changed forever.
Yeah.
We haven't really hit on the mask thing yet, but I want to, like in our Kiss episode, I want to talk about the hierarchy of masks. You start start pretty high up with like the leather face with dreads thing that Corey Taylor's rocking. You got the Sting from WWE, the Crow. I think that's the drummer, right? But it's like a pretty sharp decline into clowns and gas masks and a dude with a dick nose.
I'm pretty sure Dick Nose is the drummer. Is it Dick Nose the drummer?
No, that's the Crow. The Crow is the drummer.
Do you think that they got awarded the masks like somebody's meemaw made them?
No, so maybe Tom could speak more to this, but I watched some videos about them and in interviews. They're very into the idea that the masks really represent their personalities, as do the numbers, because they use a numbering system for their entire band, and the numbers have a great meaning to them and stuff. And so I think one of my criticisms of them, we kind of already touched on it, they are great at marketing, but in their talking about themselves, they were like, "We put on the masks so people would pay attention to the music." Bullshit.
Right, yeah. Yeah. Oh, and they talk about the evolution of the masks shows the evolution of themselves as people. I started out with like a more restrictive clown mask, and as I got more comfortable, my eyes opened up, and I was like, shut the fuck up.
Yeah, one guy has like a regular like dollar store clown mask at the beginning. You could tell it definitely elevates to like hand-painted.
Did the interviewer say, "Are you fucking with me?"
I think the interviews are all like, "We're actually, you're kind of frighteningly angry about, I don't understand what, you're a huge star making lots of money, and why do you keep yelling at me?" Okay.
What the fuck is wrong with you, man? Yeah. You're a clown mask in a fucking a onesie. Calm down.
All right. Let's move on to the next song that we are going to talk about. It is the song Eyeless.
Weird. Like, what's the Marlon Brando? What is that?
You guys ever go on Reddit and go to the subreddit, "I'm 14 and this is deep"? This is like exactly what this fucking song is about. Yeah. Oh, hell, that shit's hilarious. It's just like social media posts of kids who are like, "You ever think, man, that like the earth is like a living thing?" Jesus Christ, kid. You smoke weed for the first time? What the hell is wrong with you?
So, listen, I'm a little scared to announce this, but I think this is my favorite track.
I agree.
The chorus, as goofy as them words are, that chorus is kind of sick the way he did it. I'm not going to lie. That was the one song I heard. I was like, oh, okay, this is kind of a, what do the young people say, a bop.
Did anybody else get Surge from System of a Down vibes from him on this song?
I told you, they took everything that was hot before them and they figured out how to do it. You get a little Deftones, you get a little Korn, you get a little System who had hit, you mix in Metallica-ish guitars, and that's really what it is. They didn't totally cut out the mid-range of what they were doing. When I was listening, I was like, ah, that's the thing that gets the old school dudes into this. Because if you remember, it wasn't just like young kids with dog collars and Hot Topic shit on that were digging this. It was like metal dudes that felt that metal had changed because the quote unquote Big Four by 99, those guys had all made massive pivots to stadium success. This is after Load and Reload, and Metallica is at this point the biggest band in the world. And again, we're all of a certain age that remembers if you listened to Metallica in junior high or high school, you were a weirdo.
Yeah.
So yeah. To have that go away, to have some Americans come in and give you kind of a healthy dose sonically of what you're used to hearing and not have the trappings of hip hop, which I think really pushed a lot of the old school dudes away from nu metal. So you can listen to nu metal. You can listen to all the bands that you've been saying suck because these guys have horror movie masks and fucking onesies. I don't know what you call those jumpsuit things that they wear.
I like onesies. That's good.
and it's metal.
Yeah.
They win the marketing war. I don't know if they sat down and were that strategic about it. If so, kudos to them. But that for me is what they did that those other bands didn't do, because no one lumps Slipknot in with nu metal the same way you lump in Korn and Limp Bizkit.
Yes, and in addition to that, I think when Slipknot is successful on a track like this, it's because they're bringing in other influences. They are, you keep talking about them distilling down sort of what has worked before, but on this one, like, you start with that sample, that club sample that sounds like the Prodigy or something.
Yeah, it's like drum and bass. Yeah,
and then you get the drummer doing a really cool fill like over top of that and kind of mirroring the guitar and just doing some really interesting things. And I think that this song is successful also because it just has a broader sense of compositional dynamics. They kind of build the things and then they pay off. Another song, the record kind of goes downhill from here for me.
Yeah.
And by the end, they're building to nothing and there's no payoff. And that's just really boring.
Mm.
Can I talk about my absolute favorite part of this song? It's right at the 2:08 mark. The drums have been going hard, like nonstop. Joey Jordison is just killing it. And they kind of stop for a second and they're about to kick back in. And he hits this cymbal that sounds like this tiny little toy cymbal that is on like a child's drum kit. It's all in your head. Yeah.
I heard that. Yeah, it's like a little splash or something. Yeah, I know exactly what part you're talking about.
It's so like chintzy and shitty. And you're just like, oh, that's amazing. And then right back into...
It stands out.
Yeah, because everything else is like hyper-produced drums. And you get this like... of this kid cymbal. And right back into triple bass shit, you know? All right. Let's go on to the next song we're going to talk about, which is...
The one bad song of the record.
Oh yeah, just the only low point of the record. It's Spit It Out.
Did you never give a damn in the first place? Maybe it's time you were the tables turned. Cause in the interest of all involved, I got the promise off to the princess guilty. And I'll get my time away of here to try and stop dropping off. You were dead from the get-go, bit mouth burner. Jump a gosh, suck away, scared of me now. Then you're dumber than I thought. Always has and never was. Don't measure me to piss and vinegar. Don't tell me I smell you. Think I fear your bullshit. Just another don't blow trouble up this shit. It's another way to break through the noise. Another circle that has had to guide your band. Gotta be that way if you want it. Saturday, literal profanity, it might.
So this song was funny. I immediately thought of the Bloodhound Gang, and they also had a lot of members. I was like, what's that song they did? And it was Fire, Water, Burn. I don't know if you guys remember that. That was before this, but that was sampled off of Rockmaster Scott, The Roof Is On Fire.
I will say, this is what I was talking about. The chorus vocals where he's like, oh, you want to do drag me down? That's the fucking preset button that they're just like, 90s nu metal, there we go.
It vacillates between Gwar and Incubus, and that's not good.
No.
Wow. That's pretty cool that you know, first you know those two bands, you know, don't lie and say you don't know them.
I know them.
Yeah.
And then you heard that. I did, as a person that actually has seen Incubus live, I would never have said Brandon Boyd and I can't remember the late singer of Gwar, but
Dave Brocky. Yeah, but it's a watered down version of both. I think I can kind of see why this song was the single, because I think it's really dumbed down to the max. I mean, I think all their music is a little on the dumb side, to be honest with you, but I just found this to be one of the most boring tracks. I kind of get why they released it as a single, but to me, it's so...
So one of the interesting things about this song is that this was recorded during that demo session. This was one of the five demo songs that they recorded. And when they went to Malibu, they saw Mike Patton perform with Fantomas while they were in Malibu. And that apparently had a huge impact on the creative direction that they went with the rest of their songs. I don't know if you can actually hear it in the songs, but this seems more like they were like, oh, Limp Bizkit is what we should try to do. Let's lean more into the rapping.
I heard the Fantomas comp, and actually that's one of the things I did listen to this week was the Fantomas, a couple Fantomas records where I kind of sampled through them a little bit, and they're so much more avant-garde. I mean, they're all kind of also not for me. I like the Mike Patton, Faith No More stuff, and I like some of the Mr. Bungle stuff, but it's so artsy by comparison to this. I just didn't really see the comparison.
Oh, yeah.
Mike Patton's also an adult at that point. He's probably like in his 30s.
Yeah.
And these are young dudes in their 20s that sound like they might even have a bit of an arrested development.
Right.
Yes, I agree. Fantomas is much more on the arty side. And these guys are so far.
But you know that they think that they're kind of arty, too. You know that they think that they're cutting edge in their music. I guarantee you.
I would hope not. I would hope not. I mean, you got to be honest with who you are at a certain point.
Yeah, I've seen the interviews. I don't know how much self-honesty there is going on there.
Corey, side note, can we admit this? Corey Taylor is the perfect person to have on your horror podcast.
Oh, yeah. He seems like a pretty decent dude and down-to-earth dude.
Yeah, he seemed very cool. Yeah, I agree.
All right, we're going to move on to the next song we're going to talk about. It is the track No Life.
My freedom is best. Whole country's on house arrest. And everyone was a suspect. You can't feel the flow because you died. Face down on a suicide. The motherfuckers on self-destruct. Nobody got no back. It's all fun. Save this. My rage is blood. I'm doing it again.
It's funny you called out the guitar tones at the top for being bad, because the one thing that jumped out to me as a compliment here was that I liked the guitar tones.
On this song or in the album in general?
This song in particular. I thought in general the guitar was very unimpressive, especially compared to the drums. And the thing that jumps out to you is the drums on this record for sure as a musician. And the guitar is kind of like, that could kind of be anybody playing guitar. But I thought tonally they got some interesting stuff on this song. I don't think overall the song was such a great kind of success, but I thought the tones here were kind of cool.
Yeah, I thought this was the best musically. There's like cool guitar parts, and there's different parts. You kind of tell the difference between them.
They're different parts, but you definitely still could accomplish it with four band members.
Oh, of course. Oh, yeah, easily.
Yes. Honestly, this was one of my least favorite songs, and I got to tell you, a big part of it is when Corey Taylor is doing his like kind of angry, dirty voice rapping, it works so much better than when he's just kind of leaning into rapping like he's not shouting it at you. I didn't like it at all. This is the one where I think he like name checks Chuck D and LL Cool J and stuff. And it's like, come on, man, you don't have a pedigree to do that.
The rapping thing really turned me off.
Yes,
they're behind the times with the rapping, and I think for me that's where nu metal really missed the mark.
It was like a fucking cash grab, basically.
Yeah, it's like, well, this hip-hop stuff is cool and we like this hip-hop stuff from 88 to 91, and there were people doing the hip-hop and metal stuff way better, I think, around the same time, maybe a little later. The rap stuff with this was always really so piss poor.
It's cringy.
That's the best way to describe it. And for me, a band like Rob says, Incubus, is a little more interesting the way they use the DJ and their bass player. And they also have a pretty good drummer in that band to make hip-hop sounding stuff that's not offensive orally.
Yeah, and I think Brandon Boyd also is singing more than he's rapping. And he's not leaning into the rap. He's singing rhythmically, but he is not just like, yeah, hey, what's up? I'm rapping. Like, no, you're not. I'm sorry. You're not. You're kind of just talking fast at me, man.
That is the best new metal hip hop. Yeah.
I always try to get my son to say, yeah, boy, just to see what that's going to sound like. And he always refuses to say, he's like, Dad, God, shut up, Dad. All right. Speaking of shut up, Dad, let's go to the last song on the album. This is the song Scissors.
I play doctor for 5 minutes flat. Some wind spilled below me, and the strangest man of that head broke away my tears, smiled as I lie there. When my tongue is spread wide open, a black widow will find me a sweet doctor.
Way too long.
This song fucking sucks.
It's low point. It's got a long build up to fucking nothing.
So not only boring. That, there's like 3 fake endings of the song as well, where it's like, I could end it. Oh, no. Okay, you're going to go on. I could end it there. Oh, no, wait, you're going to go on. And what is your reward for listening all the way to the end of the song? It sounds like a man vomiting. It's not the actual track that there was somebody credited with vomiting on the track. He just like blows his voice out and he sounds like he's coughing a lung out, which is the least orally pleasing thing to have pumped into your head.
I have a grammatical problem here, which is biding my time implies until the time is right. You can only bide time when you're waiting for something to happen. So really, the second half of that line, which they repeat for like 4 minutes at the end of the song, is unnecessary.
16 times in a row. 16 times in a row.
Are you saying the song could be half as long if they just didn't say that second line?
Oh, God. Yeah, this was the one that I was just, especially coming at the end of the album. I'm like, just let me go. Release me. I want to be done with this.
They needed the ender, dude. They needed the fucking To Live Is To Die Metallica overlong instrumental song.
All right. So speaking of releasing you and letting you go, dear listeners, we're going to stop talking about Slipknot's debut album from 1999, Slipknot. But first, we are going to vote and tell you, do you really need to hear this album before you die? I am going to throw it around the room, and I am going to go first to our special guest, Jason.
Of all the new metal records of the genre, and even of this year of our Lord, 1999, I would give someone to listen to and be like, meh, it's not bad. This is not that record.
All right. Marty, what say you?
I had a lot of hope. I was like, you know what? I'm going to step out of my box. I'm going to listen to an album that I've never heard before. Someone somewhere decided that this album would be on a list of 1,000 albums to listen to. And that person is a fool. This album belongs in the garbage.
Damn. All right. I'm already holding back on his opinion, sugarcoating it. I appreciate it. Rob, what do you got for me?
This album is further proof that with the really amazingly talented drummer, you can be successful no matter how many useless band members you add to the lineup. No, I honestly don't think very many people should ever listen to this album. I do not understand its success. I was also excited to step out of my box. But I got to be honest, I glanced over the rest of the Slipknot catalog, at least the singles they released after this, and it seems like they kind of matured a little bit and got a little more compositionally dense and things like that. And so I just don't understand why we're listening to this. It just seems immature at every turn. So no, it's a no for me.
Well, sorry, Slipknot. Don't break into my room in the middle of the night with a butcher knife and stab me multiple times, but I am going to say no as well. Not a super enjoyable week. I did find stuff to like, but I really had to look. It was not initially grabbing. And then even when I found stuff that I liked, it was not, I like this whole song. It was like, I like an element of this song. You did this one thing good. Nothing was well executed from beginning to end. And I'm sorry, I don't feel like it has added to my musical knowledge of the 90s or even of nu metal. I will say, if I had to pick a new metal album between 1997 and 1999 to listen to, I would pick this over Kid Rock's Devil Without a Cause, certainly. But that is about as low as the bar could possibly get. And so, yeah, sorry, Slipknot, you are 0-4.
Damn. Well, here, can I play this sound drop?
You having an unnatural allegiance to losers is not like you.
That's right. It's Cat Williams.
Say that to the guy that made the list.
All right. So we have a few more things to do before we wrap the show up. But first, I just want to give a thanks to Jason once again for coming on our show. Jason, appreciate you coming on. Why don't you, if you got anything like socials or anything like that you want to tell our fans about?
Well, I want to say this. First and foremost, thank you guys for having me. This was a lot of fun. Also, this is a lot of work to get that level of in-depth. I do music shows on my show. I do a little bit of research, but it's usually about stuff that I enjoy and want to debate about.
Yeah, this was hate research.
I'm not really into punching myself in the nut stuff. But because you guys do this level of in-depth work and have a show with actual segments, I would want to pitch out again, sign up for the Patreon. This is a lot of work for grown men. These are three grown-ass men. So that, yeah, but I have a show. It's every Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday morning called This Is Revolution Podcast. We talk about politics and history from a very left perspective. I write a column in Sublation Magazine and in Damage Magazine. I think by the time this comes out, I'll have a new article out called Same As It Ever Was, The Illusion of Discourse in American Politics. That's all I got to pitch.
Awesome. And thank you, Jason. Again, listeners, I'm sure you can tell Jason, very smart guy, a lot of intelligent things to say, and also a funny dude. Listen to his podcast.
And all those links will be in the show notes, of course.
All those links will be in the show notes. All right. So one or two more things left to do. I actually happen to know that it is two more things left to do because I've done this podcast like 140 times. So we have two more things left to do. And one of those things is that Rob is going to reach his, I'm going to guess, Satan star ring clad hand with crazy fingernails and fake blood on it into a mailbag that is made out of human flesh and pull out some missives.
Thank you, Tom. Yeah, reaching my hand into the old skin bag here. And, I got a few listener emails to read. So I wanted to wrap up some of the Eagles Hotel California feedbacks. This is a little rapid fire here, but hopefully you guys get some enjoyment out of this. Listener Aaron writes, canonically speaking, I wonder if Don Henley is Eric Cartman's long-lost father. Don't tell me I'm the only one who hears Cartman in Henley's voice. Listener Ben writes, I have never heard songs like Wasted Time or Last Resort and feel like my life would honestly have been better if I had never heard them. Hotel California is 100% an album I wished I had never heard in my lifetime. Listener Marty from Melbourne writes,
hey Marty,
I thought Life in the Fast Lane on the Eagles album was the best tune on there. Love that guitar part. Thought you guys would rave about it. How wrong was I? Oh, and by the way, Eric Clapton can suck eggs.
Mm.
And lastly, I wanted to mention that listener Dominic forwarded us a write-up by Robert Christgau of the Eagles. It's entitled Trying to Understand the Eagles and includes some gems, or I should mention as context. First, Robert praises the Eagles a bit, citing that they are an organically formed band of good songwriters with a musical pedigree who can execute consistently. But then, he says, another thing that interests me about the Eagles is that I hate them. Hate is the kind of uptight word that automatically excludes one from polite circles, but it's also meant to convey an anguish that is very intense. Do I hate music that has been giving me pleasure all weekend made by four human beings I've never met? Yeah. Yeah, I think so. Listening to the Eagles has left me feeling alienated from things I used to love. So, thank you for that Eagles Hotel California feedback. I think what I'm getting from the email bag is that most people sided more or less with us on that one, and against Adam, thank God.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, I got one more I wanted to read you, partly because it comes from a listener so, so far afield. This is Jeff from far off Christchurch in New Zealand, and he writes in, Hi guys, Spotify recommended your podcast to me a few months ago, and I've enjoyed following along week to week, discovering music that I never would have thought about otherwise. I've also been gradually working through your back episodes, and I have a couple things to add. So first off, I play bass and keys in a Led Zeppelin tribute band, and thoroughly enjoyed your 100th episode. By the way, humble brag, we get it. You're the best musician in the band. You're playing the John Paul Jones role. Okay. Message received, dude. Special mention was made of the epic bass tone on Heartbreaker. And someone asked, what sort of amp was used? After extensive research into that very question, I can tell you it is definitely going through a Leslie speaker, most likely a Model 147, with its rotor shimmering and tube amp screaming for dear life as John Paul Jones casually tortures it. This is the level of music nerd that we're bringing in here, and I just want to be appreciative of that.
Yes, that is amazing research, and I hope that he then bought that exact rig
right,
to be in his Led Zeppelin tribute band.
He says, I also sympathize with Adam regarding having a visceral reaction to hearing out-of-tune things. I was wondering what his reaction was to the zombies maybe after she's gone. You guys skipped over it on the zombies episode, but the harmonies in the bridge are so far out of tune, it's physically painful to listen to. We're going to have to ask Adam about that, but I admit I'm curious myself.
That was like 2 fucking years ago. There's no way I remember that at all.
I love that song.
I got Slipknot stuffed into my brain.
We mostly gushed over the zombies, though, so it is kind of an interesting question to put especially Adam to the wall, who I think particularly loved that record, although I think we all liked it. And last thing he wanted to add, he said, I'd like to add to the discourse about hard panning. Stereo separation on vinyl is harder to dial in than on a format where you have two discrete channels. They're both cut into one groove, and items that get hard panned onto the master tape often get moved closer to the center as a physical side effect of the disc being cut. Thus, mixing engineers and bands at the time knew this and would quite often mix things all the way to one side to maximize the effect, knowing that it would get tamed back later, but not realizing that decades later we'd all be listening on earpods and that the extreme hard panning would be revealed just as it was on that master tape. So I believe that in most cases that wasn't the listening experience they were hoping to give us.
Interesting.
You got to invite this guy on the podcast. He'd be a good guest. Yeah,
seriously.
Yeah.
You know what, Jeff? Reach out, buddy. We're ready to have you on. This sounds really, if you can have more salient points like this. No, I think it's interesting because we've touched on hard panning so many times on this podcast, and I really had never thought of it the way that he just laid it out, that it's this physical artifact of vinyl and that they're kind of overcompensating ahead of time, pre-compensating for what the vinyl record is going to do, and that now that's been stripped away because of the digital era. So really interesting. He says, thanks for a great show. Here's to many more years of it. Thank you, Jeff.
Excellent. Thank you, Rob. Thank you to everyone who has written in, and thank you to everyone who is still listening here to the bitter, bitter end of this Slipknot episode. There is just one thing left to do, dear listeners. We are going to bust out that Albinator and figure out what album we will be listening to next week. The Albinator is in the corner. It's screaming about me because it thinks I'm its dad. It has a bunch of like black nail polish and other, I think it's freaky, but it's actually pretty tame shit going on. Let's roll it in here and give it a spin and see what it comes up with. Without any further ado, drum roll please, we will be listening to the album is The Holy Bible by Manic Street Preachers. I feel like I know that name. I have no idea what this album sounds like. Rockabilly, I'm going to guess.
Yeah, I haven't heard it either, but I think I know that this band is Welsh, and that's maybe a big part of their identity. I want to say 90s.
Welsh music, of course. I have a lot of experience with Welsh music. Super Furry Animals, I think it's the only Welsh band that I could pull out of the top of my head.
Yeah, there aren't too many. Tom Jones is Welsh, I believe.
So they all have gigantic cocks then, right?
Yeah, that's my understanding.
Excellent. Excellent. Everybody, be prepared to listen to Manic Street Preachers and their gigantic cocks as they make the album The Holy Bible. That is our homework assignment for the week. Thank you.
It's a confident title.
Yeah. Thank you for sticking with us to the very end for 1001 Album Complaints. I have been Tom.
I'm Marty.
And I'm Rob.
Boosh! Boosh!